Inspiring conversations for the modern man. The Evolving Man Podcast.
Hamilton Souther, welcome to the Evolving Man Podcast for episode number 2.
Thank you very much for having me back for episode number 2.
Yeah.
Pleasure to be here.
Great, man. Yeah, I'm excited to have you on the show again. Had you on about a year and a half ago when we were doing audio only, and we're doing audio and video this time. So for those of you who are listening, these episodes from here to four will be on YouTube. So you can just search for Evolving Man and Hamilton Souther on YouTube, and you'll find the video version of this episode. Great, man. So I suppose the first thing to say is Hamilton is a ayahuasca shaman who came from America to Peru and learned the traditional ways of ayahuasca shamanism. You now live in Peru and operate a ayahuasca center there called Blue Morpho. And you came on my show a year and a half ago, and people can go to my website or just look in your podcast app for the previous episode where we talked a lot about your journey that led you to the jungle and some of the wild stories that you had when you arrived there and what got you to where you are now. So I think there was a really good backstory. And if I missed anything in your intro, please add to it.
No, that's complete. I came to Peru in my early 20s looking for the truth behind mysticism and shamanism, and if there was really anything there that was of real merit to find. And well, yeah, I found something, you know, kind of unbelievable, really. And that kicked off a life path inside first getting involved in indigenous cultures and learning how to live with them, and then ultimately getting accepted into traditional apprenticeship, which is a very difficult thing to do, to gain the confidence of the locals to the point that you can be accepted.
Yeah.
And then all the way through training, which was life and death most of the time. And then ultimately the creation of Blue Morpho, which turned into something much more important than I ultimately thought it was going to be. We ended up reaching people from, you know, over 100 countries and thousands of people from all over the world that ultimately came down. And it's been really an incredible journey. It's, I guess that's what shamanism really is a kind of journey in the ordinary states of consciousness and expanded or non-ordinary states of consciousness. But it's been a really wild ride, one I'm really grateful for.
Yeah, it's interesting to imagine the web that you're weaving over time as people come to the jungle and then go back home and then tell their friends, and then other people come to you and you come on shows like mine. And like, as the years go on, more and more people know about Blue Morpho, more and more people know about ayahuasca shamanism and the healing work that's happening. And, you know, now even, I think we'll get into this later in the show, but there's more and more connection happening even via online spaces that connect us to you in the jungle and the medicine in the jungle. And it's almost like there's easier and easier ways for the medicine to leave the jungle and get to the people as time goes on. And COVID has provided this opportunity for you to go a little more digital from Blue Morpho and reach out further into the world and get your healing tendrils out there. Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you on this episode about the future and what might be coming. But first I wanted to, the first thing I wanted to get into is this Shaman Wars thing. And I listened to the Aubrey Marcus episode that you did with him recently a couple months ago. I highly encourage people to go and listen to that show. I don't know if it's customary for people on podcasts to recommend another podcast, but I'm doing it because I love Aubrey's show. I love Aubrey. I'll tell it to his face when I meet him, because I'm sure I'm going to meet him someday. And the stories in that episode were fantastic. Talking about, you know, what you mentioned there around like life and death. Like, I don't know if people really understand what you say when you say, like, you know, learning shamanism was life and death, like most of the time. So maybe you could expand on that, and then we'll jump into it.
Sure. You know, the life and death part was a kind of continuous series of tests, either rites of passage or tests of virtue, however you want to describe it. It's a test. And the goal in indigenous shamanism is not to make everybody a shaman, but literally carve away everybody else till the last man standing. It's the exact opposite idea of an inclusive, graduation. The tribal people are looking for the one person within the tribe that has the greatest number of skills to be able to do a multitude of tasks that are very important to the success and the continuation of the tribe. And so part of that is carrying on the oral traditions and history, the knowledge and the medicine that they have as a way of healing and treating all the different kinds of illnesses, which are very much the same as you would find in Western society. And, then it's also the means of sort of counseling and judgment for the tribe itself on how to maintain their rites and rituals and taboos, which kind of, keep the tribe cohesive. And all of those boil down to the role of the shaman within the tribe. And so the shaman has this very vast role and has to go through an incredible amount of training to ultimately be singled out as the person who's going to continue on the lineage, which gets passed down generation after generation after generation after generation. And I think people, just because they haven't had the exposure to it, are not familiar with really how long this has been going on. And in the Amazon, it's been going on for at least 10,000, if not longer, years of continuous passing on of these kinds of traditions and cultures, from one person to another throughout the tribal existence. And the tribes often are at war with each other or fighting over a whole different, multitude of reasons, just like Western societies. And with that comes this, idea of treachery and potential extreme danger. And so knowing that you're going to kind of face all of that, the apprenticeship in a traditional form has these continuous series of rites of passage, which ultimately test your life. And that test comes down in the form of the different kinds of plants that you end up working with and ingesting, many of which are poisonous. So you have to survive basically being poisoned. And you also have extended periods of time where you're in wilderness, where the idea that human has controlled, the idea of predator and prey, has not been fully transcended. So you are prey at any given moment from things like stingrays, electric eels, piranha, giant anaconda, jaguars, etc. There are many different kinds of animals that could ultimately lead to your demise, as well as a multitude of different kinds of plants that are extremely poisonous that you can run into, that you have to learn about. And then in consciousness itself, and in these visionary ceremonies that the shamans practice their medicine in, there's also a tremendous battle that goes on between both the idea of good and evil and the idea of who is strongest or who is the most powerful of the shamans. So there's sort of both this idea of one tribe besting another tribe. And then there's also this idea just fundamentally of, sort of following the taboos and staying away from them or crossing that line and going into that place that Westerners call darkness or they call evil. And I think for people who've participated in traditional plant ceremonies, it's clear that in the visions, our mythology of good and evil comes up a lot. So there's a lot of people who see very beautiful things, but there's also a lot of people who see a lot of really dark and horrific and gory and, stuff that you would think like out of a horror movie or demonography, et cetera. And so ultimately that comes to a head in this great supernatural battle of consciousness that most people are not familiar with. And it really plays itself out. The closest Western example is like a, multi-million massive online player game where there's all these different worlds and realms and creatures and beings, and they're kind of working for you or against you. And in that space, there's these tremendous forces that in your consciousness you are up against. And that could either be a nature of a direct attack upon your person, literally for personal reasons. Like in my case, they didn't want a foreigner learning. It was taboo to teach a foreigner. So there was a racist quality or a racism aspect of it. Or it could also be that someone's being paid to do these kinds of extortionary or really negative, hurtful things to another person for a variety of reasons. and they're kind of like hitmen. So they're, you know, like the, if you thought of Star Wars, they're the bad guys and they're willing to be paid to do these supernatural feats of darkness or negativity. And then there's a whole other group of shamans who have taken the counter argument to that and ultimately act as the defenders of people against that. And then that boils up down into these, you know, massive battles that ultimately take place that can last for actually generations. It's really quite a wild kind of chess match that can get set up and can last for a really long time.
Okay, so it's not all love and light, right? Like, I think people, that's foundation number one. This isn't all love and light. Like, you don't go to just any shaman and then he gives you the stuff and then it just like heals all of your shit that needs to be healed. You're just feeling safe and awesome all of a sudden.
No, absolutely not. It's definitely not all love and light. If you go into the anthropology or an anthropological outlook on the tribal societies, most of the tribal societies up until the last 50 years did not believe in pathogenic illness. They literally only believed in witchcraft or sorcery oriented illnesses. So they lived in a biosphere that is like the most rich and most biodiverse petri dish in the world. It's filled with the most number of different kinds of plants and animals that you can see. And then all of this life that you can't see, that's a cause of a tremendous amount of illness. And the tribal people fundamentally had a spiritual mythology that said that all bacteria, all virus, all invisible sources of harm, disease, pestilence, you know, illness, et cetera, was caused by rival tribes or rival consciousness that was trying to do you harm. And so fundamentally in the mythology itself, it is not this idea of all love and light, light in the sense of being happy and helpful and healing and curative and, you know, that kind of new age version of light. I mean, I do still hold the idea that it is all based in light, but light taking the shape of unbelievably crazy and difficult forms of life for us to conjure and deal with, very much like COVID. COVID, you could say, is made of light, but it's a virus that seems to be wreaking havoc on all different parts of the planet at this time, as have many other kinds of viruses and disease over the years. So,
this idea
of love and light, no.
Right. We see the fallout of COVID, but the perspective is like, you know, when you see photos of mass graves or people dying, or you see statistics of death and illness, it's like we start to see it as super evil. Even when the way they show the shape of the thing and it's like got these, like it's got the coronas on there and they're like attaching to you and they're going to kill you, you know. But I listened to a show recently with Dr. Zach Bush, who talked about viruses actually being something that communicates genetic information throughout a species. And it spreads the info out about like our code. And it's something that it's basically an upgrade, and that there's, you know, trillions of viruses out there and that we're always exchanging information with viruses. And that's what provides one of the platforms for humans to upgrade. So it is, a matter of perspective. So the kill or be killed, life and death, the battle that's going on in the jungle all the time and in nature all the time, you know, it's like every nature show you've ever watched in your life. It's like sex and killing and eating and, you know, run or chasing, you know, like that's nature, you know, that's playing out in the conscious, in the unconscious, in the world that is beyond our bodies. And it's playing out in the kill or be killed world of the shamans in training, right? It's kind of what we're establishing here. And I have a lot of questions about that because, you know, for instance, we could start with your story where you went to the jungle and you're like, I'm looking for ayahuasca. I am not sure what the hell I'm doing here, but I've had these visions and I'm called to healing. And inevitably, like I have people come to me and they're like, hey, like, what do I do? Where do I go? Like, what ceremony do I go to? Like someone told me there's a ceremony. Should I go to it? And, you know, in your case, you ended up looking for ayahuasca in the jungle before things were more established than they are now. And you got into some trouble with the first guys that you ran into.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the first shamans I ran into weren't very helpful people. They were people that were really more interested in themselves and what they could take from you, not what they could give to you. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really the defining difference between what's considered a medicine man and just any other kind of shaman. And so there's this idea of a médico vegetalista, which is a medicine man or woman. There isn't a gender bias, but it's a person who specializes in the use of plants for the purposes of healing. And then there are all of these other different kinds of spiritual practitioners, and they get basically all put into the same box called shaman. And so within that, that's very much like saying, like scientist.
Right.
There are scientists that are doing science for good. There are doing scientists that are doing science that's unbelievably questionable. It's like that. Fundamentally, you know, you're going to have an issue with your tribe, and your tribe's not going to respect you. And the work that you do is basically based on the efficacy of it. It's, you know, do you have power? And so the power to heal, the power to help somebody in need, the power to be able to conjure from the supernatural, from something beyond just the immediate that anyone would have access to, is what really gives the shaman his or her capacities. And so the nature of that power also has the tendency to be able to corrupt. And so that's where this whole idea of like evil and the dark forces come in. And then somebody starts to look for more and more kinds of power that may or may not be the kind that's specifically used for healing. And so then that leads to all the different kinds of conflicts that we see. And I think that in terms of shamanism, since there's sort of a neo-shamanic evolution or reawakening that's happening, and people are looking to try to deal with what is the greater conflict of modern Western societies by shamanism, they've forgotten that shamanism predates modern Western societies. And so, you know, shamanism and shamanic issues / shamanic wars, tribal wars, existed before there ever were all of the problems that our modern society has. And modern society grew out of those. Mm-hmm. Civilization that we know of grew out of these kinds of problems. And I think it ultimately, you know, stemmed from this corruption around the idea of power, and then power in all of the different forms that we see it manifest today. And then in the shamanic, there's this idea of needing to be more powerful to be able to perform greater forms of healing or greater forms of miracles, and then ultimately having your tribe respect you and really maintain you, support you, and need of your service. And so that's where in the really fine line of intention and, you know, the inside of you as an individual, as a shaman, really meet what is that fine line of the good and the bad, or the light and the dark. And ultimately, to be a fully healing medicine person, you have to make the decision over and over and over again that you're there for medicine and you're there for the powers that medicine hold, and not any of the other kinds of forces that could be expressed in the form of temptation or something that would take you away from the medicine path.
Mm-hmm. So that's the internal struggle that each shaman has to face, fighting working with the light and the dark in his own path. From an outside perspective, as the guy who wants to go to ceremony, you know, as the Westerner who wants to come to ayahuasca for healing, I find it difficult to know how to navigate. You know, like, I'm lucky to, I think, be in contact with some people who are very heart-centered and they bring a lot of love and light to the situation. And yet, whenever you get into an ayahuasca circle, beyond just dropping into a ceremony, when you start to talk to people about like this practitioner versus this practitioner, it seems like almost nobody's getting along. And there's a lot of like, those people have bad medicine. Those people have bad. No, you have bad medicine. No, you have bad medicine. And so someone who's coming in with like pure intentions, hopefully, you know, for me, like wanting to seek healing and growth and that kind of thing. Like, how am I supposed to, you know, at the beginning, know that I'm entering into a safe space that where I'm avoiding the situation where you did, where essentially those guys tried to kill you? And how do I know whether or not I'm embroiled in bad medicine, you know, by entering in with a certain person?
I think it's really hard ultimately to know that. And so I've always recommended that somebody do as much research as absolutely possible about the people that they would participate in ceremony with. And these kind of fly-by-night ceremonies that happen and just pass through and come around may or may not be the best choice for you. You know, in my case, it was a situation where the first people that I met were really people that were quite harmful. And then I ended up in the hands of people that were incredibly loving and supportive, but also incredibly tough, because they simply said, if you're going to survive this world with us, you have to be that tough. You have to learn what is the way of the jungle and how to survive it. And then, you know, so there, I don't hold any grudges in the sense of, you know, how difficult training really was. But if you're just looking for a ceremony that has to do with healing and your own personal healing and an exploration into spirit and something greater than that, I think you really need to do your homework to see that that's what most people are getting out of those kinds of experiences. Hmm. And if somebody has a long track record of being able to provide that for a vast majority of the people that have been in the presence of that shaman, then you can kind of hear through the noise, you know, and the squabble of this person, that person, and the finger pointing and all the different things that people like to do kind of in any sort of gossip community, and really get to the heart of the matter of whether or not you resonate with that person. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think you take just as an example, 1,000 people and they go work with a shaman. There's no way that all 1,000 people are going to like that shaman, vibe with that shaman, you know. It's no different than any other kind of doctor. They could say it doesn't have a good bedside manner, don't like his personality, et cetera, whatever. The person can be wildly in a different psychological and psychiatric state than you are. You have to understand that the comments from a lot of people that seek shamans come from a place of being in extreme pain and suffering. And then they have on some place like online an equal voice to anybody else without knowing their backstory. They could be compulsive liars.
Right.
They could be coming from literally any scenario of the psychologically infirmed. They could be sociopathic and psychopathic in their own right. So you kind of have to hear through that noise, right? So say that represents 5%, 10% of the squabble, and you see that 80, 90% of the people are coming away saying that they really got something powerful from that experience in the presence of that shaman, you can know pretty much that the shaman's doing a really good job of being able to hold space for the majority of everybody there. And then you need to see whether or not you vibe with that person's message and that person's energy and the way that that person works. And then I think that's the other thing that causes the squabble as well, is that there's really like no shamanism 101 where everyone right. all agrees on how it's supposed to be practiced. And there's all these different kinds of practitioners out there. And Western involvement has only spread that concept of different kinds of practitioners. And so then not only is it like who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, it's also if they like this person's technique or this other person's nature of practice and stuff. I mean, as a really good example of that, we have a YouTube video that was a documentary done on the work that we did as a center for over, it was shot over a number of months, about 6 to 10 months. And the majority of the film focuses on the most intense experiences that people had that literally came suffering from different kinds of possession and different kinds of extreme mental illness. It got all put together into an, you know, hour and a half long documentary. And then people see that and think that's what's happening at our center.
Right.
Right. And fundamentally, that was less than 0.1% of everybody that's ever been through our center. Most people come and have an unbelievably relaxed and deep journey type kind of experience. Yes, it can get scary. Yes, it can get hard, but it is not as, you know, enthrallingly intense and freaky as some of those images that you can see in that film. Mm-hmm. And that's really because that was where somebody consolidated a bunch of footage. I mean, like literally hundreds of hours of footage into the situations that would be most compelling to see in a, you know, in a film. And the real reality is that thousands of people have experienced unbelievably calm experiences with us going super deep into the medicine space without having that kind of turmoil. But mm-hmm. then if you talk individually with the people that had that turmoil, they have very good reason why they had that turmoil and what they were going through and why they were releasing those kinds of energies in those ways. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think you have to really kind of cut through the chaff and really get to the heart of what's really being said about somebody. And I think you can also look at how they treat the kinds of criticism that they've received. So if you find somebody that treats criticism with a real amount of openness and heart about it, and doesn't really engage in the squabble, just kind of lets it happen, I think it's also really telling of that person's spirit. And that's what you're really interested in and when you're looking for a shaman. Mm-hmm. And I don't think one medicine circle is particularly better than another one. I think it's a question of whether it's going to be more effective for you. And so that's where it becomes a very personal, you know, decision that you need to go deep within yourself to see, okay, is this person getting enough good reviews to, you know, pass that test? And do I really resonate with what the other people who are coming out of this person's experience are saying happened and how I see them transformed? Mm-hmm. And I think those are really big keys. And the other thing I always said is look into their eyes as well. They say that eyes are sort of the window into the soul. And so look into the person's eyes and see if they're clear and if they look honest and if they'll look you in the eye and really tell you what's going on. And then on top of that, I've always said, ask questions. And if they're unwilling to answer the questions, then to me, that's suspicious of something. And I always want to know why. Mm-hmm. So we've always played this as a complete open book about what was going on. There was no need for secrecy. The plant medicine space was so intense that secrecy wasn't needed to make it more intense. On the contrary, it was so unbelievably intense, it needed to be broken down into bite-sized pieces that people could actually absorb and deal with because of how mind-altering and expansive over such a short period of time that experience could be for somebody. So even the person who thought they were most prepared could come to a ceremony and the next day just say, I had no idea. I was not prepared at all for that, right? Yeah. So, I remember that from my first experience. Within 17 minutes, I realized that I had gotten myself into a deep situation that I was going to be lucky to survive. And I really do feel lucky that I survived it. You know, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And that wasn't even a situation where I was being harmed. That was actually just an unbelievably deep healing that I didn't know somebody could actually even have in terms of a conscious experience. It was so intense and it was just so throttling and it was so fast in terms of the visions. I mean, like I describe it as 50-100 strobe lights at the same time going off, each vision having to be dealt with in this like multidimensional soup of spirit and intradimensional geometry that you're kind of suspended in as consciousness, no longer embodied, and having to fend for yourself in that for the first time ever was completely different to university education or high school, you know, like just such a different form of learning that, you know, I didn't think that this needed to be mystified. I think it needed to be demystified and studied because it was something that was so amazingly transformative, but also so impactful in such a small amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, one of my questions from one of the listeners, it fits this piece that we're talking about. It's almost like we need like a Yelp or an Airbnb for shamans, for people to leave reviews. I mean, review systems have their issues, of course. Like on Amazon, you've got people buying reviews, and there's the whole market for reviews. But in a sense, like if everything's going digital like this, and things are going all over the place, and you've got rogue ceremonies happening in Boulder, Colorado, and all over the place, like, in some sense, it would make sense to have some kind of a structure, because that's part of the issue that we're talking about here, is that there's like no structures for anybody to sort of grab onto or lean on other than, you know, having to do some form of deep research, but like where and how, you know? But the question that my friend asked, which was great, I'm not sure if all of this needs to be taken literally, but I like how he worded it. He said, What do you think, Hamilton, about all of these LA shamans doing backyard ceremonies with ayahuasca they ordered from Amazon? Does the plant spirit prefer that she's reaching more people and that she's more powerful, and so more powerful than the shamans? And so, like, it's fine. You know, her love is overpowering their lack of experience. Or is it genuinely a bad idea to pursue medicine with an inexperienced shaman? Right? This is my friend who lives in California and moves around the West Coast and does get invited to these ceremonies. And it's a question I often get asked. And before you jump into your answer, I want to mention the show that I watch sometimes. It's called Kentucky Ayahuasca. I don't know if you've seen it. Have you?
I've heard of it. I have heard of it. Yeah.
It is interesting. It's on Apple, I think, and I download it and then I watch it when I'm on planes because I can't, you know, watch anything else when there's no Wi-Fi on a plane. Very interesting. This guy like runs, you know, like a addiction treatment center out of his house that involves people just showing up for the weekend with their bags, and he serves them ayahuasca in the basement with the lights on at a table, sitting at a table. They come up, they drink it. He sits there and talks to them for a bit. They go lay down. Maybe they come back up and drink again. The lights are on the whole time. And he's like, I don't have to do much. Mother Aya takes it from here. She knows what to do. You know, and you're like, whoa, this is going to be a train wreck. But interestingly, it's like, it's not always a train wreck. It's not often that it goes really bad. It actually goes like, okay, most of the time. So, you know, how do people navigate with all this, all these choices?
I mean, I think we could need to first break that down a little bit, right? I mean, there's a lot packed into that. There's a lot packed into that. First of all, I think, there's two kind of main governing thoughts within the ayahuasca circles. And one is that the ayahuasca is the medicine, and the other is that the ayahuasca is the tool and a facilitator to the medicine. And I think that that's just a real big division line. And that's something for you to decide for yourself. Traditionally in the Amazon, the ayahuasca is not considered the medicine. So that is just considered a false belief that was propagated by shamans and Westerners that said that ayahuasca was la medicina, and it's a bad translation about the plant itself. And then the idea of the mother of ayahuasca is also a bad translation, ultimately, to a very gender-dominated Western society that was looking for a Gaia, a Pachamama, a Mother Earth, a very strong, supportive, feminine presence that could be helpful. Ayahuasca is a shapeshifter in the sense that it can take on literally any shape in any form. And so if you're looking for the mother, you can find the mother. And if you're looking for the father, you can find the father. If you're looking for the grandmother, you can find the grandmother. If you're looking for the alien, you can find the alien. If you're looking for the next version of a spiral galaxy, you can find that from ayahuasca. It can take on literally any shape and form. It can take on things that look completely nanotech and futuristic, and it can take on things that look like prehistoric, like the time of the dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. It can take on literally any shape whatsoever. And so the idea of the shaman training and going through all the kinds of things that I went through was to learn how to wield ayahuasca so that depending on the individual needs of the people that are in the ceremony, you can help give direction and guidance to ayahuasca to take on the shape and needs for that person's individual consciousness. And the ability to do that one-on-one is one thing, and then it gets multitudes of more difficult the more people are in ceremony with you. So by the time you get to 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 people in ceremony with you, and you're one or two master shamans working on that number of people at the same time, you have to have an unbelievable skill in training and how to work with the plant spirits to understand how to wield the medicine. And the medicine is actually an expression of a kind of healing capacity found within plant life that ayahuasca becomes a gatekeeper to. So it's not just the ayahuasca itself. It's in the different kinds of medicinal trees and medicinal plants that are all considered to have, quote unquote, what they call genios, or these geniuses / genies. It also translates poorly, but it means doctor spirit of the plant that can come to you and provide you healing through a resonance or an energetic form in the visionary state itself. And that the ayahuasca helps you into that visionary state, but that that plant medicine spirit exists as an entity completely independent of ayahuasca. And that an ayahuasca shaman in the Amazon is functioning as a conduit and a bridge between you and hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of medicinal spirits that are under different kinds of hierarchies, like La Madre or the Mother Ayahuasca, which then is a means to be able to provide a tremendous amount of spiritual support and healing to people all at the same time. So for instance, you're calling on La Madre Ayahuasca to be able to govern 5, 6, 7 kinds of trees like Rimu Caspi, Capirona, Shiwawaku, Anacaspi, Chuyachaki Caspi, through their head medicine spirits to be able to bring a couple hundred thousand of these kinds of different entities to the ceremony that are all different kinds of doctors so that you can handle the needs of 40 people that have all different backgrounds all at the same time. Hmm. That's the real practice of traditional ayahuasca shamanism in the Amazon. And so to be able to have that skill, doing it through the form of chant and ikaros, through the form of invocation and the knowledge of those spirits themselves that come from nature, that come from astral, that come from water worlds and come from the earth plane itself, are all skills that you gain that are not part of the conversation and not part of the vocabulary, and it's not part of the understanding or the mythology of what we see in these quote-unquote backyard ceremonies. Mm-hmm. Now, in the backyard ceremonies, it's said that the ayahuasca is the medicine itself, ergo the facilitator really is a person who knows how to make a tea and functions like a bartender.
Right.
And what I would say is that that is a tremendous insult to the thousands and thousands and thousands and literally thousands of years of people who trained anywhere from 10 to 20 years to be proficient in what it is that they're doing. Yeah. So it's like the difference between saying, you know, a cardiologist and just giving a bunch of scalpels to another person and saying, well, you know, go do an angioplasty on that guy.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Valve replacement. Yeah. Like, just go for it. Like, hey, why not? Because the, you know, the medicine is in the scalpel itself, right? Uh-huh. It is a complete, this is the Amazonian traditional shaman's attitude. It is a complete fallacy that what's happening is that the ayahuasca is functioning as a medicine. It's rather functioning as a conduit or a means. If you understand it from that point of view, though, we can unpack the idea of the backyard ceremony and why people are receiving healing. They are becoming their own shamans. Hmm. The moment there isn't a shaman who's really doing shamanism for you, you are your own shaman, whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. And the people come with such a strong belief, and they come with such a strong desire for healing, and they come with such a strong intention for healing, and they come with such a strong need for healing, that they really do tell that to the ayahuasca. And the ayahuasca is one of the kinds of medicine spirits that can provide that kind of healing.
Right.
And so in the absence of an actual quality shaman, you end up being the shaman for yourself. And in the kinds of documentaries that I've seen on those kinds of ceremonies, that is literally what I see. I see that the facilitators do not know how to interject themselves into crisis moments for the people that are in crisis. They try to support in some kind or another, but not with the same kind of skills that I saw, you know, really trained shamans in the Amazon know how to work. Just like if you were taking somebody in an ER and everybody in the ER knew what to do in that moment that you had that specific kind of head trauma, or you had that heart attack, or you had, you know, that seizure, the ER trained people would know exactly how to handle that situation. And mm-hmm. then they would all start working together as a team. So I see sort of a desire by these people who are supporting to provide that kind of support, but it is a kind of untrained support compared to what I've seen in the Amazon with really trained shamans working together to be able to handle, you know, an acute crisis or something that is, you know, happening that's very intense within those ceremonies. So I'm not saying that the backyard ceremony is really all bad in any kind of way,
right,
but I do think it is missing the point of the principal shaman. Now, if you mm-hmm. had the choice between being your own shaman and being with a bad shaman, you're better off being your own shaman. For real, 100% better off. I think the bad shaman is actually going to do something with skill that could be harmful to you. And you're not going to do that to yourself in theory, you know, especially if you go in with the intention of medicine and love and healing, which is what we base our ceremonies in. So medicine, love, and healing. Medicine is all the energies that can make things better. Love is how you are inextricably linked to source, with source in, through, and all around. And people can use whatever religious or non-religious context they want for source, but it's how there is a universe, just so we're not like quibbling over mm-hmm. terms. And mm-hmm. it's just how there is a universe, source. So that power, that mm-hmm. thing that made all of this possible, you know, and so if you're really connected to that medicine and source and heart, you're going to do really well in that ceremony. You're going to be able to get through it. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately in the shamanic journey sense, if you end up in a ceremony that leaves you, in the quote, bad medicine space, where now you have unfortunately not gotten what you've wanted from the ceremony and things have gotten worse for you, you now have to go on a shamanic journey to find a healer, just like I did, who knows how to actually handle that situation, who can fix that for you. And that would be considered by the shamans completely normal in shamanism. It's not completely normal in the Western world,
right.
But it is in the sense of like litigation, right? You have a problem and then you have to go on a journey to find a lawyer and then you have to figure out how to navigate the system and hopefully come out on the other side better off.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very much akin to that same kind of a situation. I personally think that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of inherent danger whenever you're tapping into a direct and absolute change to your consciousness, which is what these ceremonies can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so considering that set and setting is unbelievably important, and knowing a lot about the set and setting is also important. It's not enough just to say, hey, I'm just going to go to the woods because this place is this unbelievable place in the woods. I had a client recently before COVID who came to us who thought they were going to have a ceremony that was going to be great in this place in the woods and found out it was a location of a Native American massacre that had been cursed. And when they opened up into the visionary space on their own in that, they opened up into that curse and all of a sudden were attacked by all of the dead Native American warrior spirits that had been part of that cursed location. So you might even need to dig in deeper into the nature of the location that you're in, thinking that mm-hmm. set and setting is also the right place to kind of be.
Mm-hmm.
When you come to a center like ours to have these kinds of ceremonies, you at least know that it's a place where we've been practicing for a very long time, doing this service for thousands of people, and have had a very long positive run of outcomes, even though there are going to be some people that are critical about the nature of their experience for a lot of different reasons. And I think you need to, in that sense, be really rational and think about why that person might have had that experience. And often the person could have had that experience because of more of them than the center itself or the shaman itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of people who are not really appropriate for these kinds of ceremonies, and screening them out is almost impossible. So you can do the most advanced medical screening that you would like to do, and you could still have people lie, and you could still have people distort the truth, and you could still have people fundamentally do things that make it even more dangerous for them to be participating in these kinds of ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's such a full-on experience that, inevitably some people get knocked off their rocker,
And just feel like they're not ready to have had that experience. I mean, that's where I am. I'm still integrating my first ceremony. So I'm thousands of ceremonies into the game of Amazonian shamanism and into being a practitioner of lots of different kinds of shamanism. And that first ceremony changed the trajectory of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still integrating it, but I consider that to be a tremendous gift, not something that was in a sense negative, but it was, so whelming. It showed me that there was a whole other world to explore that I didn't know that existed before that. And then ultimately would require a lifetime of study and immersion to, try to even understand better, let alone master,
mm-hmm.
And so I think of myself still as a student of the universe, trying to understand more and more about plants and consciousness, and ultimately how plant consciousness and human consciousness is part of a field of consciousness that we're tapping into, and learning how to perform very miraculous changes to our consciousness through this interaction of plant and human.
Mm-hmm. So you're on your own journey, and you're a leader in this space, in this whole space that's opening up in humans right now, where more and more people are seeking to explore their consciousness and look deeper. And, there's a psychedelic revolution happening right now, especially in North America. And so I think it's important that we're having these conversations. Just to review, the worst thing you could do is be with a bad shaman or someone who doesn't understand the practice. Neutral would be, better than the worst, at least, is practicing on your own in a safe space. And I've done a couple episodes talking about that and how to set up set and setting. And, I know more people than ever right now who are going and doing, 3, 4, 5 gram sessions with psilocybin and just putting on an eye mask and laying down, and by and large, those experiences go well when people do their research and they figure out how to set things up so that, they enter that space of becoming their own shamans. Like they open to healing, and they face their fears, they face the darkness, and they learn to start navigating the space. And the best case scenario is to find someone who's within a lineage, you know, someone who's received that 10,000 years of wisdom passed down to them, and be privy to that healing. One of the things I wanted to ask you is that, you know, from time to time, I've done a couple plant dietas, both with Pino Blanco, actually. I did one earlier this year, and I take psilocybin mushrooms from time to time, mostly in the format that I just described, where, you know, it's a high enough dose that I'm not walking around and doing anything, and that I'm flat on my back, breathing, listening, and communing with something else, or LSD. And I find that doing that is in conflict with, you know, what my teachers are telling me that I'm doing with the plant dietas. And I'm finding some level of frustration personally. You know, of course, I don't like to have my freedom taken away, but I also, it doesn't feel like it's in conflict for me. Like I don't understand how I'm perhaps like pissing off the plant spirits that I've done diets with by intentionally engaging psilocybin versus ayahuasca. You know, I'm kind of like, what's the difference? You know, I don't feel the difference. It doesn't feel like darkness, you know, any more than ayahuasca feels like darkness, you know, from time to time. What do you say to that?
I think you're butting up against a mythological conflict that exists within the Amazonian ways of thinking about these different kinds of plants. And I actually had the exact same scenario happen to me early on in my training, because I was down here and I was interacting with these trees. And, you know, you're talking about doing tree dietas, and that's really part of what's called palero shamanism, not ayahuasca shamanism. It's a whole other field of shamanism, right? Like a whole other kind of doctor. And typically you take these tree barks or leaves or flowers of the tree, depending, or roots of the tree, depending on what kind of tree you're using or what kind of medicinal plant you're using. And you make a tea out of it and you drink the tea. And then you go and you do this process called dieta, where you basically follow a very strict diet. It's a lot of restrictions. You know, you're saying the freedom being taken away. Well, there's abstinence of almost everything you could think of other than just the smallest amount of calories you need to kind of stay alive during that time. And then you go into a trance state naturally as you start to sweat out all your salts and you don't really have any other kinds of oils or fats and you have very low calorie diet. And you start to become a very trance-like, dream-like state. And then they say the plant spirit comes to you and it starts to teach you. And I asked the shamans, well, why do you only diet one tree at a time? Why don't you diet two trees, three trees? So you can diet up to maybe three trees, but you can't diet more than that. I said, well, why? I mean, explain to me this. And they said, well, all the plants get jealous of each other. And I thought for a second, I thought, I don't want to be dealing with jealous spirits. I came here to get rid of jealous spirits. What are we talking about? Like jealousy wasn't something that was supporting my overall existence. And this is where we get into the idea of the, you know, the local Amazonian person who kind of takes a very balanced attitude towards duality, sort of like, yeah, well, there's the light with the dark. It's not, I'm here for the light. It's you're getting the light with the dark. And so there's all of these restrictions saying that the plant spirits get, as you said, like frustrated with you or mad at you, or they even can punish you in some traditions, they say, for different kinds of activities or different kinds of things that you do as you're learning the discipline of the diets themselves. And so I fundamentally asked my own teachers if I could leave that aspect of the tradition, because I was only interested in interacting with what I called the medicine spirits of the plants anyway. So I didn't want the jealous aspects of the tree. If the tree had something jealous going on with it, well, it needed to release that just as much as I did. So Hey, all right, Piñon Blanco, whatever, you know, Chuchuasha, we're going to not be jealous anymore. So we're all going to learn how to get along anyway. And then I was confronted by a conundrum that made literally no sense to me, that I was told that I was going to do, you know, 20, 30, 40 of these tree diets of these different kinds of trees. And ultimately, they were going to be going down the same mouth and into the same body. So they were going to ultimately have to learn how to get along in one body anyway. It wasn't like there was going to be 30 Hamiltons that were each one going to have a different tree. So I'm like, wait, this is like an apartment complex inside here. And they're telling me that none of the people in the apartment complex can get along, right?
Yeah.
So I'm like, no, we need to redefine this whole thing. So I started doing dietas of lots of different trees together. I tried to, you know, do as many trees as you could possibly do within our tradition. I worked up to that. Mm-hmm. And it does get exponentially more difficult. It's not any means easier, but I did find that those conflicts that were being talked about were really more mythological in their tradition than they were innate to the tree spirits themselves.
Okay.
So again, this is going back more to the belief driving the outcome than the plant driving the outcome. And so I think because the people themselves had those kinds of issues, they were experiencing that with the plants. And what I ultimately did, because I came from tradition the very same way, where you were not allowed to use any other kind of medicinal plant other than just the trees of the different kinds of specialties and then the ones that went along with ayahuasca. I ultimately branched out beyond that to all of the different kinds of medicinal plants that you could use for these different kinds of healings. And I used a practice that I developed that came from a thing that I called modern shamanism, which was a way of making all of these spirits get along and coming from a place of medicine and love and union and unity for all of them so that there wouldn't be an issue, and that I would go through a process of diplomacy with these spirits to introduce them to each other. So if I were going to, you know, use cannabis, I would bring cannabis in to all the other spirits. I would call all the other spirits and say, hey, these are the head medicine spirits of cannabis. Meet cannabis. Cannabis, meet these guys. We're going to all learn how to get along here and not have any kind of energetic conflict.
Yeah.
And I would spend the first, I don't know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, hour of that first time that we would all meet, you know, in the body itself to get comfortable with each other so that ultimately we could get to a place where I would call it dance, where we would get to that place where the energy becomes ecstatic and everything becomes really agitated in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And everything becomes very bubbly and effervescent and ultimately super multicolored and ultra geometric. And then all of the visions are inside that field and everything in it is getting along and there isn't any kind of energetic tension or push or pull going on. And everything is ultimately harmonious and, you know, straightened out and everything's shining bright, you know, rainbows and lights and everything's just shooting rainbows everywhere. And it's really like the most beautiful expression of consciousness you could possibly imagine. You look down at your hands are shooting rainbows out of it. Your body's shooting rainbows. The spirits are shooting rainbows. Everything's just all these beautiful rainbows going everywhere. Like that's where I wanted to get this place of this medicine. Right. Mm-hmm. So I would do this diplomacy thing with the spirits. And I ultimately realized that those aspects of the tradition were necessary for those people who believed in those aspects of the tradition, but that mm-hmm. wasn't going to be the relationship that I was going to have with the plants, and that mm-hmm. we were ultimately going to have a much more expansive relationship. And I simply did it through this introduction of the head medicine spirits. And so, you know, I agree with you that I don't see that there is an inherent conflict. I think that that's a mythological belief system. I don't see why it needs to be perpetuated. It's existed for a period of time. And I think there's a reason for the discipline. And I think that that's also part of the training, and that there's this mythological way of understanding in the Amazon, and it's not so literal. And Westerners come to it and they think it's really literal and it's really quite mythological. So it's a little more Dungeons and Dragons, and it's a little bit, you know, more Bhagavad Gita than it is the way Westerners treat this idea that it is this way or it is that way.
Right.
So you're learning a kind of discipline, and that discipline is very important to your medicine practice. So they describe it in a certain kind of way that I think is a little bit different than fundamentally the truth, which is that right. The discipline is what's key in the dieta, which is, you know, to learn that yes means yes and no means no. And when you're going to sing a certain kind of ikaro of a tree, you really know that tree and you're really expressing that tree. So when you call on that tree, it is only that tree and your mind doesn't fragment. Because when you get into the visionary state, it's like this unbelievably prismatic state. And you have to learn how to focus within that state and hold that focus on a very specific kind of tree or on a very specific kind of spirit and not get spun out, especially when you're the shaman working for a number of people. They can go anywhere into whatever. And I call it herding jaguars. It's not just herding right. cats, it's herding jaguars.
Big cats. So,
yeah, big cats. So you have to be able to be super laser focused in that unbelievably prismatic state that's happening all the time. And, you know, the stronger it gets and the bigger it gets, the more work you can do, but then the more focus you have to be able to hold. And that's part of the discipline that you learn inside that training, which I think is fundamentally really important, and then gets spoken about in this mythological way that doesn't really make so much sense for us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that feedback. I think it puts it in context for me, and you know, I'm walking this line between, like, I really want to respect the traditions. I want to respect the people that are teaching me what they're teaching me and who are sharing the medicine with me that are, you know, that they're sharing. And I also want to, like, I want to feel where the truth is between the truth and mythological stuff. And I want to be able to sort of find my own way through that without disrespecting other people's beliefs or what people are saying about how this world is, because like you're saying, it's kind of, some of it's very subjective. And I want to find my own path while respecting them. And I also want to innovate like you have, right? Like you came to the jungle, you learned the ways that they do things, and you know, respected the way that they were doing things. And you, when the time was right, I think you learned to layer new things on top and try new things and, you know, find your own way within the medicine. And that's something I respect about, you know, what you've done here with this. And so, you know, I think you're a good example for probably a number of people, but for me as well, in how to, not abandon myself in the presence of a teacher or a shaman or someone who has some special knowledge that I want, right? And just like believe everything they say, you know, like that. This is how people get stuck in cults. This is how people also get into a space where they're limiting their own growth because they get so focused on the teacher, you know? So yeah, I think it's important to remain focused on the teachings, and those teachings are changing all the time as you attune your listening to sort of what's coming in, you know. And sometimes what's coming in doesn't feel true anymore, doesn't feel right, or feels like kind of off, you know, like, oh, these things are jealous, you know. They're, you know, I always had that criticism of religion where I was like, oh, God's like a jealous, vengeful guy, you know, who wants you to burn when you do something bad. Like, that doesn't really make any sense to me, you know? And then I hear the same sort of thing about, you know, what the plant spirits are like in the jungle. And I understand it to some effect, but it doesn't seem like hard truth, you know, or at least like perhaps bypassable, like what you're saying, you know, where you're like, well, I want to figure a way around that, you know, like, you know, how can I be a part of the solution here? I have some other questions from people, and maybe, you know what, maybe we can get into the future. Cause I wanted to ask you about this. Like, 2020 has been a weird year. You know, I think most people know that in certain parts of Peru, ayahuasca tourism is a big thing. I mean, certainly in Iquitos, and you run a center where people come for ayahuasca healing. And I know of a number of centers where it's, you know, there was complete lockdown, and just like the hotel industry, all these centers are shut down, you know? So you're, what's it been like, first of all?
Yeah. Since mid-March, we've been shut down for the first time in 18 years. And It's been a really quite intense time. I mean, for everybody in the sacred plant industry, it's basically just gone, you know, it's vanished, and there's no idea to know when Peru's going to reopen and, or, you know, how many people will still be around and part of this world when it does reopen. It was an unbelievably intense time here. For the first 4 months was just it was insane. And I don't know how to describe it better than that. It was one of the most intense periods of disrupt I had ever seen. From one day to the next, police and military took the streets and the city was completely shut down. And then from there, all commerce stopped. And every port, roads, airports, everything was just shut down in a national state of emergency. And then within 2 months, there was COVID through the entire city. And within 4 months, over 400,000 people had been exposed of 500,000 people in the city.
Oh my goodness. Where's this?
In Iquitos.
In Iquitos. Peru. Everybody got it. Wow.
Yeah. So it's been over 95% infection rate. There's now herd immunity for however long that will last until there's another wave. If there will be another wave, we're kind of waiting to see. But hospitals collapsed. Society almost collapsed. It barely made it through. There was a period of civil disrupt that was associated with just the intensity of it all.
Yeah.
And people were basically quarantined in their homes in unbelievably high urban density and just getting sicker and sicker. And then there was on top of it, a dengue fever epidemic that hit at the same time.
Oh my God.
And there's no way to know how many people actually died.
Yeah.
The tragedy is unbelievable. And we all know people that died. So I've lost, four or five unbelievably close friends during this period of time. And of family friends, relatives of relatives of relatives that all passed away over the last 4 or 5 months. It's been really intense. And Blue Morpho, what we did as a company was we immediately took the most intense procedures you possibly could. So our city offices started to look very much like a biohazard facility. And we just did everything we could to try to control the virus coming into our space. And for the people that were out in the jungle, we were completely isolated. And I headed a group of us to use the natural medicines to boost the immune system and stay strong, utilizing dieta like we talked about on a monthly basis, as well as a ceremony to deal with the isolation and trauma. Mm-hmm. And we did healing work the whole time. And that was really what kept us going through this entire time. And then that work ultimately turned into a whole digital expansion of ours called bluemorphoretreats.world. And the Trinity Retreats, Maestro Christian, who actually got stranded back in the United States when the borders all got shut, was there. And so he and I agreed that we would take everything that Blue Morpho was that we had learned, that was the best from the Amazon, plus the best of all of these other traditions that we had learned over the years, and put it all into an online retreat to help us transcend the fear of COVID and teach us how to boost our immune systems and use natural plant medicines that are completely legal all over the world, herbs and flowers that you can get literally off of, Amazon or from your local health food store or supermarket, and even set it up so that people could do the retreats if they literally couldn't leave their house. So they could do water fast with us and go to their spice cupboard and utilize the different spices in their spice cupboard and some, herbs and vegetables that they might have had in the refrigerator, and be able to be part of this experience to kind of shake off the intensity of what this COVID quarantine was for the people that were hit the hardest, and do something about it that was actually really positive. And so instead of taking a fear approach, it was take a caution approach to the virus itself and be careful about it, but then also teach how to be able to use plant medicine as a way to empower yourself, both spiritually, energetically, mentally, emotionally, and then also for the immune system itself, all of the different plants and plant medicines and teas and stuff like that could be powerful to boosting your immune system during this time, so that if you did come in contact with it, well, maybe you'd have a much lighter response to it, or you would actually be able to fend it off before you even got it. Uh-huh. And so that's what we ended up doing. And so we created bluemorphoretreats.world and the Trinity Retreats, and we hold them on the weekends. It's a Friday afternoon, Saturday afternoon, and Sunday afternoon. So people can do what they need to do in the mornings. And we host it all through Zoom and online chat services. So we form a community around the retreat experience. And we have full-on ceremonies at night. And we use breath work, ecstatic breath, if people are in places where they don't have access to legal plant medicine. And if people are in places where they have access to legal plant medicine, then they can supplement with any other kinds of plants that they're using. And the only thing we ask is that it be responsible in legal practice. And people are having unbelievable experiences. I think the most amazing experience was also at first one of the biggest kind of barriers that people had was the thought, can I have this experience in my home? Is there a way to transfer this experience through the internet to somebody and not have to go to the retreat facility and actually have a profound experience? And what we found by through most of our participants was that actually by doing it home, it was even more profound for them. It was the exact opposite. It was more profound because they were in their environment that normally is just so normalized that they couldn't believe that it could be transformed into a shamanic space, into a ceremonial space, and then into a place where they could have these ecstatic states of consciousness and real ceremonial experiences and deep dive communion with plants and with plant spirit and energy right from their home. So through the guidance that we would give on a really, truly a step-by-step way of helping people understand how to do this together from your own home and then interconnected through the internet made it possible for people to have unbelievably powerful experiences. And it's been growing little by little and something that is now turned into to something very special for us. You know, we're really excited about what it is. And when Blue Morpho gets to reopen, kind of the if and when, we will continue to do this regardless. We found that this is an amazing form of integration for people. There's all this, you know, talk about going to centers and having this tremendous high and then going back into normal life and kind of going back into a low. Well, we figured this solves that problem. This is something you can do at home to keep it going. It's also something that you can do to introduce yourself to these kinds of practices before taking the deep dive and going in person to a center where you're so committed. This is also unbelievable because if it's something that you're not resonating with, well, you just shut off the feed. You know, you didn't fly halfway around the world to go, you know, to kind of try it out or test it out. And so we found that this is really an unbelievable way to share these experiences with people, introduce them to this experience. We've had lots of people that were Blue Morpho guests whose family members were interested but never could make it to Blue Morpho who could participate in these experiences with us. And so it's expanded that aspect of our community. And it's also really gotten us to embrace the digital side of community and really see how to turn it into community. And we're doing that through our own Telegram channels and really getting Telegram community going. And we have a fully self-sustainable community there that's all about positivity and love and healing through plants and supporting each other, live a better life. And that's now growing. And we find it to be much more intimate than the kind of space like Facebook. So these chat apps are really, really quite amazing ways of being able to create community while we're supposedly being separated. We're bringing each other together digitally and teaching each other how to maintain connection and community during this time. We also created what we call the Trinity Scholarship Program, where people can donate to Blue Morpho Retreats. And then we give out retreats to people who are in need, and we give discounts also to people who are in need so that there's literally no barrier to entry based off of finances. We know that COVID has absolutely crushed some people financially, and other people have actually benefited from it, funny enough, as it is in the world. And so people who've benefited are giving, and people who are in need are receiving. And so some people pay partial amounts of the retreat fee, and some people pay 2, 3, 4 times the amounts of the retreat fee to be able to give to others. And it's becoming also a sustainable way that people are giving to each other. And so we haven't had to turn away anybody because of financial reasons. And that was something that was super important to me during this time, that we could transcend the money barrier and have this be something that anybody could participate in. All you have to do is email us at info@bluemorphoretreats.world and ask to participate in the retreat, and we can find a way for you to be able to be part of it.
Yeah, you guys are keeping the healing going. That's fantastic. And you're evolving, right? You're evolving as this...
Have to.
Right? As the whole thing evolves.
I'm
just so blown away that what you told me about what happened in Iquitos and the fact that it like wasn't like I was reading news, but that news didn't reach me. That is, it's the amount of infection and like how bad the system broke down in Iquitos. Like I would have thought that I would have heard of that. And it's a crazy story, man. Like it must have been the most challenging time you guys have ever faced down there.
Truly. Yeah. I mean, it was wild. I mean, for people who know Iquitos, the wet markets were really the kind of heart of the culture in the city, and they've been bulldozed out, just completely taken out, just gone. It became a huge political thing here. The decisions that were made about how to handle it. But, you know, ultimately the society held together, which I'm actually really, you know, proud of. I'm really proud of the fact that they considering how intense it was and considering what Peru has faced, Peru has shown its real grit and solidarity as a country and as a society, and they've pulled through, and little by little they're now opening up and starting to see the light on the other side of this period of tremendous tragedy. It's you know, COVID is, it's not totally under control yet, but they really are doing the best that they can. But the disrupt has been absolutely total. It's been unbelievably brutal. And, you know, so if people can help out, centers like ours and other people in the plant medicine space who, you know, care, the need is there, and other people are in need of these kinds of ceremonies and help as well, and retreats to be able to, you know, just get through this period of time. And some places got hit really hard, and it was truly apocalyptic here for, you know, 4 or 5 months. Luckily now all of that's passed and things really are almost back to normal, but there is that lingering trauma within the and sort of, you know, shock that's within the society itself. And, you know, there's actually a lot of hope that things will be better, but we are also waiting that idea of a second wave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody is. So you created Trinity Retreats, which is really cool to me. Like it's funny how, it's not funny, but it's just interesting how the pressure from COVID has caused so much innovation. You know, so many companies, you know, just at a basic level, companies that didn't have their employees working from home figured out how to get their employees to work from home and aren't even going to go back to having offices, you know, and so many programs that have been created to, you know, bring knowledge to people or to connect people, you know, and thank God for Zoom, right? Like this thing would be a whole lot different if people weren't able to connect like you and I are connecting and like your people are connecting on the Trinity retreats. And so you've put together this curriculum that you know, facilitates you bringing the medicine to people wherever they are in the world, you know, and what a gift that is, you know, that people don't even have to necessarily fly and come down to Blue Morpho in order to get a taste for this and to contact the medicine. It just allows you to impact so many more people. I just want to talk about breathwork for a minute because I love breathwork and it's been such a transformative tool in my life. You know, like ayahuasca is a tool, breathwork has been an amazing tool in my life. And I've always considered this like combining like some plant dieta fasting with breathwork, you know, and I've done that when I did that when I was on my recent plant dieta, I was doing Wim Hof breathwork. Mm-hmm. But the idea of doing ceremony together is sort of a next level thing. And it's in hindsight, after hearing you mention it, it's kind of a no brainer, you know, like you're bringing in all these allies and then you're bringing in this tool. And then the container of having everybody together doing this at the same time, the safety of that, it's a perfect recipe for transformation for people. So I just want to say that's really cool. And what I want to ask you is like, what do you see in the future? You know, I have friends who are futurists. Like I have a friend who asked, like, do any of the shamans see the future convergence of psychedelic medicine, nanotechnology, and virtual reality and artificial intelligence sort of like all coming together, you know? And like, is there talk of that in the jungle? Is there talk of that in your circles? And, you know, like I always have this feeling that I'm preparing for something, you know, like humans are sort of working towards this, some kind of pinnacle, or I don't know what it is. You know, sometimes my mind's like, oh, it's war. Or other times it's like, it's environmental devastation where we all run out of food, you know? Cause like there's all these things that obviously we're not in great shape as a people right now. And, you know, what do you see in the future and how do you see this medicine work implicated in that future?
Well, I think the future is already here. So, you know, the future comes from our imagination and we imagine these amazing technologies and we create them out of what's available to us. So I see that there's going to be a convergence of all the things that you mentioned. There's going to be synthetic biology connected to nanotechnology, connected to artificial intelligence, connected to total robotics, self-creating robots, complete lights out manufacturing, and ultimately fully autonomous computerized systems that make human individual intelligence, you know, remote, or no longer even purposeful in a way. And we have the ability to outcreate ourselves, and we also mm-hmm. have the ability to extinct ourselves, but we don't have the ability to extinct life, and we don't have the ability to destroy the earth. Those are just false concepts. The earth made us, the earth can destroy us. We can't destroy the earth. We can evolve the earth. We can modify the earth. We can do lots of things to the earth, but that's still the earth. It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that no matter how the earth changes, that's the earth's change, not just the human's change. And so I think the big concern in the dystopian side of it is that we can change the earth so fast now that we can change the evolutionary bubble beyond our ability to evolve with it. Like, we evolved as a species over a very long period of time, really over millions of years, to ultimately be the shape we are and what we are today. And we can only live within a certain, temperature range, and we can only live within a certain oxygen range, and mm-hmm. beyond that, and pressure range, and beyond that, we're dead. And so that is an unbelievably finite container to represent the nature of our life. And we have not found a way to extend that container literally at all. We've only found a way to be able to extend life. And so considering those limitations on us and what we're doing currently in this sort of what I think of as like uncontrolled, ever creating of innovation on innovation and competition to kind of push this thing forward, we're not taking enough time to understand the implications of our own creations. Mm-hmm. And so that will ultimately happen at some point. I think around the idea of food source and food scarcity, that's basically a question around method. And method will change and be forced into innovation, just like you've talked about COVID. So I know lots of people that have thought about lots of different kinds of renewable permaculture-based food scalability. And so that's there. It's just not there yet. And, fossil fuels are still unbelievably important, but fossil fuel companies also know that other kinds of energy is unbelievably important. And they've moved into other kinds of energy as much as they're still involved in fossil fuels. It's like the idea of just being one thing and then not evolving, I don't really think is that truthful. I think really the companies want to continue to succeed in every way that they possibly can. And some will and some won't in this like ever competition of battle that's taking place, which is in its own kind of war. Humans are going to come to a place where they have to make a decision. And that decision is going to be the decision that is going to define then the rest of the future for humanity. And I have no idea into the future how close we are to that decision, but it is coming. It could be in our generation or it could be in five generations. It's unknown, but it's coming very, very soon. And that is whether or not we are going to continue a dystopian dualistic form of thinking and choice, or we're going to abandon it into a unified way of understanding Earth and humanity. Hmm. If we do not make that decision, the future for us has already been written by us. It's that this ever battle that's going on will ultimately escalate in ways that will be outside of our control, and it will become the Earth doing it to us, not us doing it to the Earth anymore. And so, if you put all of those technologies that we talked about together into one massive technology, that's not human controllable anymore. So, well, then what is it? It's Earth. It was human spawned. It's Earth spawned. Now it's the Earth doing it. And I think that's what people don't understand. So as soon as coding languages can code faster than coders can code, computer systems will code themselves and create themselves faster than humans can object. Mm-hmm. And yeah. As soon as factories can build computers and larger computers faster and can computerize the rockets that send the satellites, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, just building on that kind of concept of just like ever industry of itself. And it's designed to want to do that through this very finite language of duality of, this voltage versus that voltage, which is just really an unbelievably binary way of and dualistic way of understanding the future. it will do that. And we will, for a period of time, champion ourselves as, you know, the great intelligent creators of the planet. And then we will all of a sudden realize where that thing is out of control. And that's been talked about in lots of different kinds of ways. And so, you know, we will have a decision to make as a collective group. And I think that that's ultimately the purpose of democracy, and that democracy is still alive and present, even though people might not be paying as much attention to it as they are to the hoopla around democracy.
Right.
But ultimately, I think democracy comes down to choice, and that choice has been given to the people pretty much unilaterally throughout the earth. And there will become a choice that will be made at some point about that. And I don't think it's your choice or my choice or any one of the listeners' choices. It's the choice. And I think it'll be, you know, a huge evolutionary step for humanity at that point. Or we will choose what will be our ultimate destruction. And then while I care personally about humanity, I like to think of, you know, 300 million generations, 500 million generations. I like to think of humans being around for 10 billion, 20 billion years. Mm-hmm. If the universe has just been around for 13, 14 billion years, it would be really cool if humans could be around for another 13 billion years, you know. But yeah, the reality is that humans have been around for maybe 500,000, maybe a million years, maybe. Maybe a little bit longer than that we'll find in the archaeological history. And most species have gone extinct of Earth. And I think that's kind of hard to take in and fully understand. But we have to accept our own mortality. And we have to accept the fact that most species are already have been part of Earth, and that that's part of what evolution is. Mm-hmm. I think what's super unique about our species is that Earth has put into our hands the ability to make the decision for the Earth whether or not we will continue or we won't continue. And I don't think any species has had that level of say in the continuance of a species ever in history. And so I think that that is really a historic moment for us. And at the current level of philosophy, like I say, the decision's already been made. It's been made in a state of chaos and individualization and ego and identity. And then you ask, well, what does plant medicine play in that? Well, that's where the plants start to get involved and start to put really interesting ideas in people's heads, you know, start to really, really change the nature of how people think. And people have been eating plants forever. I mean, we are plant. We are made of plants as well as made of lots of other aspects of Earth. And, you know, these plants are talking to us and communicating with us. And lots of people are now realizing that that is a scientific phenomenon, not just a mystical or religious phenomenon, to be having revelations coming from other sources of plants through this bridge of human consciousness and plant consciousness. And that it is, like you say, a vast, acceptance that's taking place kind of on an almost global scale now, that there is something more going on to life itself, and that the plants have something to do with that and are part of that, whether it's in psychotherapy and psychiatry, or whether it's in shamanism and plant medicine ceremonies, or whether it's in the New Age, or whether it's part of science. It doesn't matter. It has found its way into like literally every single aspect of where we are forging ahead and creating discovery. And so we as humans have brought plants into that space. The plants have started to communicate with us, and they're sharing with us new and interesting innovative ideas about how to address and deal with what could ultimately be a cataclysmic failure in our own philosophy. Mm-hmm. The plants have a way to be able to change people's philosophy, which is vastly fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That somebody can think something and then change. So I think that's where we have this opportunity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What I'm reading from that is that the more people we have connected to plants, the more people that we have sort of tuned in, the more we can respond to the signals that are being sent, you know, from Earth, from plants about, you know, how to be or what to do next. And so, you know, I guess that's where your role comes in here. And in, you know, my role as an individual doing my own work in how this whole story plays out. I wanted to ask you, some people were asking, like, do you still diet? Are you still learning? Do you ever get disillusioned with the weight of the work as a shaman and want to quit?
Yes, I still dieta. So yeah, I do dieta. This year I've already done 5 or 6 dietas. So absolutely. I still practice all different kinds of ceremonies. I use plant medicine ceremonies. I also have ceremonies that are all other kinds of plant medicine ceremonies. I work with hundreds of different kinds of medicinal plants. Some are visionary, some aren't visionary in the sense of the chemical components making them visionary. But to me, they're all visionary. Once you know how to have visions, you can tap in and connect with the plant. You've ingested the plant. Mm-hmm. It's in you. So once you've learned how to tune into its vibration and communicate, you know, it's just a very deep theta state that you go into. It's a very deep trance state. It's like a very dreamy state. And then you can connect. And yes, I experience at times all different kinds of disillusion, like anybody else. And I treat that same kind of disillusion with the practices that we've learned to treat difficult times. I mean, right. It's hard. So yeah.
Yeah. I like what you're saying about being able to sort of tune in. And once you learn to have vision, you know, cause I'm like still working on my ability to have vision and to like sort of know where I am when I'm in the like totally blasted open psychedelic space where everything's light and rainbows. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to come back to the Trinity retreats because, you know, one thing that you shared, you know, in a previous conversation was about medicine world and how you created this safe, loving space called Medicine World at Blue Morpho through like years of work and refinement. And, you know, in many ways, it's like, it's a next level above this whole, like, you know, you got to protect the space so that the darkness doesn't come in and invade and you've got attackers coming in over here. Like Medicine World is this next evolution, this next technology that you've created, that, you know, just provides that, you know, loving light container for people in ceremony. And it's certainly something that I want to experience. And so I definitely plan to do one of these Trinity retreats in the winter because I've been planning a dieta for the winter anyways and a fast. So I look forward to do that. I'm going to bring some friends with me and we're going to do a bunch of us will sign up for Trinity retreat this winter. But yeah, I just wanted to mention Medicine World for a minute. And yeah, is there anything you want to say about that part?
Sure. I mean, Medicine World is key to how we do this. I mean, there's, you know, like you were saying, this philosophy that you got to protect and all these bad things can come. But that's the us versus them, mm-hmm. you know, dynamic that we're trying to get out of. And so we learned and I learned and ultimately created this thing called Medicine World, which is a kind of consciousness technology that we teach through the Trinity retreats to teach you how to hold a space and create a space and define a space for your shamanic practice or for your trance practice, your ceremony, that is all based in stable universal states of consciousness that we all share together. So we become one network of consciousness that is all focused on all of the kinds of connection that we're experiencing, not separation that we're experiencing. And in all of the different definitions of connection that we're experiencing, universe, time, I and the I am consciousness, how we're all self-aware, the motion, the interaction, the totality of our own being, part of the totality of the universe itself, with heart, all sharing heart in the decision of the heart, in the choice of medicine and the decision of medicine and the decision of healing, creates a space that is truly governed by this idea of medicine itself or love itself or source itself that then takes out of the space this, you know, fight or flight scenario of all these energies and the spirits. And so we practice through what we call sanctuary and medicine world, the totality of the retreat. So we go into that space together and we invoke that space together in the first group meditation. And then we learn how to utilize that space through the totality of the retreat during the day and at night. And it goes on for the 3 days so that we can become comfortable with that idea and continue to practice with it beyond the retreat itself. And it creates a fully safe container for people to be able to experience any kind of breath work, meditative work, you know, trance work, sacred plant ceremony work, which then takes out of it all of these questions that we were discussing before about these, you know, like major danger zones that exist inside the plant medicine space and plant medicine ceremonies. Yeah. And so ultimately I wanted to come up with a technology that could do that for me so that I didn't have to do that while I was trying to heal people. So I wanted the space to be the technology for me that could do that. And so, you know, I ultimately defined and codified and isolated all the universal states of consciousness that we share. And then through that, we create an interweb that we're all part of. And that is how we build Medicine World for the retreats itself.
I'm a huge fan. I am a huge fan of this when you describe it. It just feels so right. It feels so right that you've cooked up this sort of next level thing that you can share with people. And you're giving it to them, you know, so they can carry it in their hearts, so they can walk around with it, you know. I'm, as someone who sort of, you know, I'm not exactly a dabbler. I'm more of like I kind of jump into things and study them for a while. This is a tool that I'm really excited to learn from you, and a tool that I want to be able to share with other people, you know. So I'm in for Trinity Retreats, and I also want to come down to Blue Morpho and bring some people with me, and you know, once we can, you know. And so, you know, you and I can talk about this offline, but for people listening, if you're interested and you want to do a group thing, I can keep you informed if you go on my website and just subscribe to my email list. So evolvingman.com, go and subscribe to the email list, or send me an email through the contact form and say, hey, I'm interested in these. I want to go to Blue Morpho. Like, let's go on a trip. You know, I'll create a list, and then we'll talk to Hamilton about how many emails I get, and we'll see what we can do. Cause I definitely want to come and experience some of the medicine that you're describing with Alberto and like all the stuff that you've learned throughout the years and Medicine World. It's an amazing technology. So I want to respect your time. I want to thank you for coming on the show, Hamilton. Really appreciate you coming on a second time. And, you know, before we get to, you know, the social details, et cetera, is there anything else you want to share?
No, I think we covered everything. I just want to let everyone know that we're offering a space to come in and experience everything that we talked about. And we have this way to be able to do it online now, and hopefully soon we'll have a way to be able to do it in person. But the online work is unbelievably powerful, and I think it's really worth giving a try. And I think it's really important too, if you have had an experience where you've had bad medicine, or you've run into any one of these things that we've talked about, there is help for you. And we are one of those resources that you can get help through to reset completely and get past whatever it was that was traumatic about those experiences. And we don't have to do it with psychedelics. We can do it just through breath work and through the ceremonies themselves, utilizing really good medicine and really good ikaros. And so I just want to let you know there is that resource out there for you. It's not like if something goes bad in the psychedelic realms that it's over and there isn't any way to be able to come back from that. There is. And there is help. You just have to know the right kind of people who know how to do that work. And our group is a group very specialized in that. And we love to be able to help people who've ever had negative experiences like that. So if that is something that you've been through, I just want to let you know that that resource exists, and you can come find it through us.
And it's low carbon. It's a low carbon, low cost access to someone with years of experience, good intention, awesome technology. You know, like as much as I want to fly to the jungle, and I am going to fly to the jungle, I acknowledge that every time I take a flight, I'm burning jet fuel and I'm contributing to, you know, some of what we're facing as a species here, you know? So like there is something to be said for low carbon, high impact initiatives, you know, and this is it. So, awesome, man. Trinity Retreats, bluemorpho.world, bluemorphoretreats.world, right?
Yeah, bluemorphoretreats.world and the Trinity Retreat.
And you're on Instagram, Hamilton Souther on Instagram, and Blue Morpho Retreats?
Yeah, Blue Morpho Retreats on Facebook, and there's the Trinity Global Community on Telegram, and Hamilton Souther on Instagram. I'm also personally on Facebook as well. So you can find us pretty much everywhere. Awesome. If you want to check us out, please do. Please join our community. Please be part of what we're doing. Like I say, it's all about love and positivity and helping each other live a better life and ultimately having a positive impact on the planet. And I think we just do that one by one by joining together and really living our very best. And so it's not hard. The whole idea is to make this easy and make this even easier on us for our spiritual development and personal development. And it's about being in an inclusive space where you know that you're loved and supported, and you can give that to other people as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks again for coming on the show, Hamilton. Much appreciated. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a great one.
Thanks, brother.